Welcome to Statewide Reports and Conversations from in and around Illinois and the Midwest. This hour, we'll talk about nursing. A federal effort to reclassify the profession could have a wide-ranging impact. We will talk with a nursing educator about what it could mean. We'll also hear a story about elder care, a woman who had to become her mother's nurse, and her book that examines the assisted living and hospice industry. We'll hear from a couple of Illinois college professors who came to this country as international students. They discuss the current climate for those studying here. The Illinois-based car manufacturer, Rivian, says it's becoming a leader in autonomous vehicles. We'll find out more about that. And we'll look back to a shipwreck, the most famous to occur on the Great Lakes. It happened 50 years ago this past November. We'll have those stories and more ahead on Statewide. This is Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. At the age of 99, Judy Karofsky's mother was kicked out of her hospice facility in Wisconsin. Within 48 hours of that decision, Karofsky became her mother's default nurse. She's written a book about the experience called Disorderly Conduct, The Flawed Business of Assisted Living and Hospice. In it, she chronicles nightmare scenarios as her mother aged and died in the American healthcare system, making her way through independent living, six different assisted living facilities, memory care, skilled nursing, and hospice. She talked with Kate Archer Kent.
Your mother died just shy of her 100th birthday. Mm-hmm. Can you tell us about Lillian Deutsch and what she was like?
She was a spark plug. People just gravitated toward her. I'll just take you through the period after I went to college. She just walked into one of the largest corporations in America, the New England office of what was then AT&T, and said to them on the ground floor at the receptionist desk, "I'm here for an interview. You have to hire me." Mm-hmm. And they did. So she had a natural tendency to understand the world around her.
What were her relationships like with her caregivers that surrounded her in these assisted living facilities?
My mom loved her caregivers. I can remember one caregiver coming in on a Sunday on her day off to take my mother to the highest floor in the facility in which she was then living so she could overlook the Madison Lakes just to spend time with her. Mm-hmm. I can remember another one who on her day off brought her newborn son for Lillian to hold.
These relationships, though, were short-lived because of the staffing turnover at these facilities. Is that right?
You're so right, Kate. And that's a problem nationally. And the caregivers, although they came in with love, they wanted to help and they wanted to learn. I learned that they were not trained sufficiently. They for sure were not paid sufficiently. They were not represented. We do not have a union that serves them. So they're in many ways exploited by the business, by the industry. And in many situations, so the facility who was unable to increase its staffing level on any given day would make a call to an agency for a temporary, or many temporary caregivers, all of whom I'm sure came with the same desire to be helpful, but they didn't know the residents, they didn't know the meds, they didn't know the schedule, and they were not really helpful in the way that we needed help, that my mom needed help.
And yet at the same time, you write that there's been this explosion in assisted living facilities since 2018. Why are we seeing so many of these facilities open if they can't be properly staffed?
Why are we? Because these are businesses that are not supervised. These are businesses that have no federal oversight, no federal regulation. I can tell you that in Wisconsin, there are some regulations, but they're minimal. And until we have some oversight, this falls into the category of profiteering.
We're talking with Judy Karofsky about her new book. It's called Disorderly Conduct, The Flawed Business of Assisted Living and Hospice. And she wrote it after her mother's experience of aging and dying in these facilities. Judy, the cost of long-term care in hospice is staggering. I mean, you paid $17,000 in rent up to facilities during your mother's last 2 months of life. Why is it so expensive?
Because it can be, quite honestly. Paying for somebody who interviewed me said, this sounds like it's just a hotel with some services. And I said, yes, that was the model at one point. And I also in the book, Kate, discuss hospice. And the hospice is not, we're not charged for hospice. So if hospice becomes part of the caregiving team, that does not add an additional cost. You would think, I thought, that once hospice became part of my mother's caregiving team, there might be some reduction in the rates from the assisted living, but that didn't happen.
Your mother breaks the timeline for hospice and is kicked out of hospice. Can you talk about that rule, those rules of hospice?
Yeah, as I just said, hospice receives its funds through reimbursements from Medicare, and Medicare sets the rules. And the rules are this: people who are near death are eligible if a physician on the hospice staff, the local hospice staff, can or will determine that that person only has 6 months to live. Well, how can you do that? I mean, you can for, unfortunately, you can for some situations, but my mother was not suffering from either heart disease or diabetes or cancer. And it's even difficult with those three, but those are the three main medical problems that bring people to hospice. My mother had a more lingering situation. She was aging. Aging was actually what my mother was dying from. So when she was 99 and a half, they said, she's been on hospice for too long. And within 48 hours, the hospice nurse would not do anything with or for my mother because she was no longer a hospice recipient. I had to find a wheelchair for her. I had to keep track of her meds. I had to buy all the bandages and supplies that she would, cough medicine. She was going through a lot of cough medicine. So that was exhausting for me and quite unfortunate for my mother. At the very end of her life, she was reinstated in hospice. They did acknowledge that she had declined to the extent that hospice could be involved again.
What did this do to you and your life? You were in your 70s and
I was
being the
70s.
Point person on Care for Your Mom. Mm-hmm.
It made me aware of the failings in the industry. It made me aware of the untruths, of the deceptions. It made me aware of abuse, Kate. Unfortunately, my mother was both sexually abused in one facility and physically abused in another facility to the point at which a police person was called. And I have pictures of those bruises. I just did one step at a time, one day at a time, because during the days, this woman was still fun. She recognized me. We did not lose that. So I was blessed in that sense that she knew who I was when I walked in the room and her face lit up. And who would not keep coming to have that welcome every day if able to do it? And I was at that point retired and able to spend all the time with her. And she was fun. If I took her in the summer, if I took her for a wheelchair walk, she loved the gardens along the way. She knew where she was. There were certain foods that she liked to have. But underneath it was heartache because I knew that, doing the best I could, that my mother was not receiving the kind of care that she deserved, which meant that others next to her, with her, in the same room with her, were not receiving the care that they deserved.
How do your mother's experiences that you lived yourself, how do they inform your own choices going forward in your life?
Personally, I've recently relocated, so I no longer have a house with stairs to the basement to the laundry. I have a one floor situation, but it's not in a facility. And I'm looking ahead because I can't be blind about it. to a time when I have two bedrooms. I'm sitting in one of them now, which is my office, and a caregiver will accompany me. And that's everybody's dream. It's always been the cry, no nursing homes. Of course, nursing home is sort of the generic term. And included in that is the sense that people also do not want to have to go to assisted living. But the time comes, and I listened after my mother had her stroke, and I had no choice. I could have moved into her, but there wasn't a way that I could do that given the type independent living apartment that she was in. I have no answer, but I have good thoughts. I don't know. Mm. And my hope is that those who are faced with a decision more timely than I am will pay attention and say, this is not what we can or should be doing.
Judy, thank you for sharing your story, and thank you so much for joining us.
I'm so grateful to you for bringing this issue to light to your audience today, Kate. Thank you.
That is Judy Karofsky. Her new memoir is called Disorderly Conduct, The Flawed Business of Assisted Living and Hospice.
The electric vehicle maker Rivian has unveiled new technology the company says will put it at the forefront of autonomous vehicles. Rivian, based in the Bloomington-Normal area, Charlie Schlinker has more on the story.
Rivian is making the case it is ready to catch up with and surpass Tesla in self-driving vehicle technology. At a company event, Senior Vice President of Electrical Hardware Vijay Rajagopalan says vehicles made in Normal will have multiple cameras, like most competitors. She says they will also have 5 radars for 365-degree vision and LiDAR. LiDAR uses ultraviolet or near-infrared waves to determine ranges to objects. That helps in rotten weather and at night.
A third-gen autonomy hardware system is capable of processing 5 billion pixels per second of sensor data.
The idea of LiDAR has been around since the 1930s. Archaeologists have used big, bulky units to map out the remains of ancient cities from the air since the 1960s. Rajagopalan says the technology can now fit seamlessly in a car.
About 10 years ago, LiDARs used to cost in the tens of thousands of dollars. Today, you can get a very good LiDAR for several hundreds of dollars. The resolution of LiDARs has similarly improved tremendously.
Rajagopalan says another difference maker is Rivian has made its own computer chips, processors, and AI software, which will make Rivian quick to improve. It won't have to work through outside hardware and software vendors to make sure all the parts work together. Rivian is billing its new AI driving system as robust by any measure. The multi-chip processor can handle 800 trillion operations per second. It's more energy efficient than something bought from outside the company, and Rajagopalan says it has other pluses.
By building purpose-built silicon, we do not carry the overhead that comes from leveraging a design that was built for some other task and repurposed for autonomous driving.
Most autonomous vehicle companies have what are called ground-truthing vehicles to teach their AIs better and safer driving. They drive around and accumulate data on best practices and real-world conditions. Rivian Autonomy and AI Vice President James Philbin says Rivian system is better than the rest.
But because they're prototypes, these fleets are typically small, numbering the tens to 100s. In contrast, for the LiDAR-equipped R2, every vehicle will become a ground-truthing vehicle. That's orders of magnitude more data.
Most AI is based on large language models. Rivian's is based on what's called a large driving model, or LDM. And it has what the company is calling an apprentice running in the background, learning from what's going on.
But imagine this process running millions of times a second across millions of scenarios with a whole database of road rule costs and losses. And that's how LDM is trained. And we can then distill this model into one that we can run on board. All of this work results in new models, continuous enhancements, refinements and new features that we continuously deliver to our customers.
One thing about using human data from drivers in the wild instead of curated drivers following the rules, ordinary people don't always make the best choices. Take, for example, approaching a stop sign.
The vehicle slowed almost to a stop, but then rolled it. A lot of our Rivian data is kind of like that. The one in the middle here, yeah, they're clearly stopping too soon.
Philbin says Rivian can sort for data that catches drivers doing what they're supposed to, slow to a stop behind the line, and train the AI to produce the preferred outcome. He says Rivian can set its software to filter for certain scenarios and mine that data immediately. Philbin says the company has also listened to owners who said they want more road coverage, and the latest improvements expand on what had been a relatively small hands-free map of about 100,000 miles of road.
Universal Hands-Free unlocks over 3.5 million miles of hands-free driving on roads across the U.S. and Canada. If there's a painted line and it's clearly marked, you can now drive hands-free.
Rivian's dreams include more than point-to-point hands-off driving. Eventually, they want eyes off the road, which means someday you'll be able to ask your car to drop you off at the airport, drive home with no one in it, and then pick you up when you get back. You may not even have to own the vehicle. The company says its AI opens opportunities in the ride-sharing sector. Here's Chief Software Officer Wasim Ben Said.
The gap between software-defined vehicles and traditional architectures is getting exponentially wider with AI.
Rivian also unveiled a digital assistant in its vehicles that's billed as much more than a chatbot.
You have two events today. Call with Tim from 2 p.m. to 2:30 p.m. and meet up with Wasim from 3 p.m. to 4 p.m.
Can you move my call with Tim to 5 p.m.?
I've moved your call with Tim to 5 p.m.
Let's go to my meetup with Wasim.
Navigating to Ferry Building.
And Wasim Ben Said says Rivian is positioned to add capabilities as they come on the market.
The assistant has memory, has context. It remembers the full story, who you're talking to, where you're going, and what you just searched for. And then it puts everything into a perfect message.
All of this, hands-free driving, eyes off the road, plain language commands, Rivian wants to use that to give people back their time.
Can you make the seats toasty for everyone except me?
I'm Charlie Schlenker.
We have more to come on Statewide. Stay with us. And welcome back to Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. On a recent edition of SIU President Dan Mahoney's Office Hours podcast, he explored the impact and experiences of international students on the SIU campuses and their communities. The topic of international students on college campuses has received a lot of attention recently because there was a significant decline in those students' enrollment across the country, primarily due to visa application difficulties, including delays and denials. The decline across the SIU system has been about 15%. President Mahoney sat down with SIU faculty who first came to the U.S. as international students. Elza Ibrosheva from Bulgaria and Jeb Ashervatham from India have since become leaders, researchers, and mentors. They share what surprised them the most about life in the U.S., starting with Elza.
I will speak to my experience as well as first arriving from Europe in the United States. I surely was very shocked to find out the situation with public transportation. And to this day, every time I talk to international students, this is one thing that they all share. How do you take the bus? If the bus doesn't go in the type of routes that you experienced as a primary means of getting from place to place, that surely comes as one of the biggest cultural shock. And I would add to this one also the lack of walking sidewalks when the bus is not available. So there are a lot of adjustments that you frequently have to do based upon expectations and constructions of your idea of what the United States looks like. It's quite interesting to experience once you are on American soil. And I would add my second really surprising experience was the vastness of everything. There is absolutely no way one can prepare if you've never gotten to be in a place so beautiful and so big, both in terms of land, but also physicality of landscapes. And I felt a bit scared at the beginning to sort of think about how do I navigate this on my own, but also embrace the opportunity to be adventurous and to ask and lean into the resources and the community around you, which is another amazing thing one discovers when you arrive from abroad is how very, very welcoming and warm the people surrounding you really are and are willing to assist you in whatever way they can. And that was another wonderful thing about my experience in Carbondale.
Jeb, anything you'd like to add?
Yeah, on the last point that Elsa mentioned, I knew about hospitality homes, but I didn't expect the community to be so involved in providing assistance and all that. Particularly, I see like churches, they actually give rides and all that. I was so surprised that they would even give material, assistance and all that. From the university side, I did not expect so much student service to support both academic and social life. I've never had that support, or at least I've not seen that much support back in India. So that was really surprising. There's so much support available for both academic and social life.
Like many international students who came to the U.S. to study, you stayed and continued to work here and make wonderful contributions in our communities. And I should point out, Jeb was the author of our economic impact study, so he directly benefited us here at SIU. And Elsa actually has been involved in a number of things. She led the accreditation process for SIUE. She was part of a national award we won for course sharing across the system. And you can either give her credit or blame her. The whole podcast that I'm doing is her idea. So both of you have made contributions in a lot of ways, some of which I've directly experienced. But Jeb, starting with you, what factors were critical in that decision to stay?
It was really the academic system that really drew me. This was a very simple concept here. You know, you work hard, you get rewarded. There's a lot of good research and advanced research going on here in the United States. But also we look around, like among faculty, I would see like so much collaborative work and just the whole attitude towards collaboration, just going approaching. So that really freed up my mind to be actually here and see that this is really good. And also just to just the freedom to work at any university, and the mobility was much more here than like what I see in India, where usually people work at one university and then just stay there for life.
As I mentioned earlier, when I first arrived into the U.S., I imagined myself as coming here for opportunities to grow professionally. But soon enough, after I began to take all of these advanced classes in journalism, I actually found a real deep fascination, and I would even say love, for doing research. I actually found the idea of becoming a professor and becoming a researcher very appealing. And I couldn't imagine myself being in another place that have the opportunity to support such intellectual endeavors as the United States higher education system.
Elsa Ibrosheva and Jeb Eshervatham, members of the SIU faculty who first came to the U.S. as international students. They spoke about their experiences with the SIU president, Dan Mahoney. When it launched in 1958, the Edmund Fitzgerald was the largest freighter on the Great Lakes. On November 10, 1975, the massive ship went down in Lake Superior during a wild storm. All 29 of the crew members died. 50 years later, there are still questions about what happened in the final hours before the sinking. The history of the ship, the lives of the men who served, and the repercussions of that final voyage are the subject of a new book, The Gales of November, The Untold Story of the Edmund Fitzgerald. And the author is John U. Bacon. He spoke with Doug Tribou.
Your book includes a lot of great history and context about the region, the Great Lakes, the shipping industry, and how the stage was set for the Edmund Fitzgerald to become sort of a celebrity, record-breaking freighter. Would you explain, though, how the fresh water of the Great Lakes creates challenges and dangers that ship captains don't encounter in the salt water of oceans?
Well, I grew up on the Great Lakes, and yet a lot of this was surprising to me. Experienced sailors, commercial sailors, will tell you that the Great Lakes are more dangerous than the Atlantic Ocean, which seems impossible. But here's why. One reason is the salt water mutes the waves on the ocean. So they're not pointy. They're like big roller coasters. Spreads them out. They're twice as far apart as they are on the Great Lakes. The fresh water makes pointy waves like a mountain range, which means you can have the bow of a ship like the Emma Fitzgerald in one wave, 30-footer, and then nothing in the middle, and then your stern in another wave, 30 feet high, which means it's going to crack in the middle. That's one of the theories about the M. Fitzgerald.
And then the freezing of the water in storms is also a factor because fresh water freezes more easily.
Far more easily, and it weighs down the ship by hundreds of tons. It's just crazy. And can make it tilt to a side, starboard or port. And now you're having a real problem.
The name Edmund Fitzgerald is so associated with the ship and its ultimate demise that I was surprised to learn from your book that the freighter was named not for some historical figure, but for someone who was very much alive when the freighter was built. In fact, it was his idea. Who was Edmund Fitzgerald?
He was the CEO of Northwestern Mutual Life Insurance, still a gigantic concern in Milwaukee. They insured the shipping business. They insured the mines that produced the iron that the ships would carry. But also his five great uncles were all captains. And his dad was one of the greatest shipbuilders in the Great Lakes.
The Fitz, as it was often called, stood out in a lot of ways, from the engineering that went into its design to a set of luxury accommodations on board. Tell us about some of the things that made it unusual for its time.
For one thing, it was the biggest on the Great Lakes. It's 729 feet, carried the biggest loads, and also one of the fastest ships on the Great Lakes. It was also the most luxurious, as you said, which seems oxymoronic. This is an iron ore carrier. But the cabins, the kitchen were all first in class. This was to attract the best crew in the Great Lakes, and they did. And the VIP quarters, which they had for their clients, the guys paying for all these services, two staterooms with air conditioning, plush carpeting, color TVs, which were, none of these were common in hotels at the time.
Right.
And why is that? To make sure the money keeps coming in.
As you note in the Gales of November, watching Great Lakes shipping freighters is a bit of a spectator sport. There's a two-story viewing gallery alongside the Sioux Locks in Sioux, St. Marie in the Upper Peninsula. Highly recommended. It's really fun. I've been there with my family to do it. And the Edmund Fitzgerald developed a following right from the start. How big was its launch party in Detroit in June of 1958?
They launched in Detroit because that's where the ship was built. 15,000 people came out in the middle of the day, a work day, to celebrate the launch of the ship. They outdrew the Detroit Tigers.
The Edmund Fitzgerald quickly started setting Great Lakes records for the amount of cargo it was hauling, as you mentioned. What were the most common things for the freighter to be hauling, and what was a typical route?
Almost always, this ship would carry pelletized iron, 500 million pellets per ship. That's enough to build 7,000 cars, and they would do this once a week. They'd go from Duluth, more or less, to Detroit or Toledo, and then go back. It was called the Toledo Express for that reason, and they did that trip 50 times a year.
The Fitz's final captain was Ernest McSorley, who took over in the 1972 season, a few years before the sinking. What was McSorley like, and how did he run the ship?
The short story, he was the greatest captain on the Great Lakes, and I've got current sailors who sailed with him, against him, and so on, all saying the same thing. One guy said, "I saw that man park 729 feet of steel between two ships with 3 feet on either side, as though he's parallel parking his F-150 pickup truck." He was the best in rough weather, they all said. He's also the most aggressive in terms of never turning around, going through horrible weather. Your strength is your weakness, of course. But also, he's a fundamentally decent guy who was so loyal to his people, and they were so loyal to him, that they would follow him from ship to ship. They loved that man.
So let's talk about that final run in 1975. The Edmund Fitzgerald set off from Wisconsin on November 9th, fully loaded, and Captain Ernest McSorley chose to take what is known as the northern route across Lake Superior, turning south as it got close to the Big Lake's eastern shore. The captain of another freighter, the Arthur Anderson, did the same that day. What was the early part of that run like, and what were the problems both ships encountered?
Well, Sunday, November 9th, was 70 degrees in Duluth. There's a storm coming in from Alberta, Canada, bringing cold, dry air. There's also another storm coming up from the southwest of the United States, bringing hot, wet air. It's all going to collide over Lake Superior, right in front of Whitefish Bay, and McSorley always went straight shot across the lake, but this time he decides to be cautious. But it's going to add 14 hours to the trip. That gives the storm 14 hours to get there first, and now you're in unfamiliar waters.
The Arthur Andersen, the other freighter, was about 10 miles behind the Fitz when it got the last communication from Captain McSorley. There had been some understated calls from McSorley to the Andersen over a period of hours, but no specific mayday call at the end. And one of the most remarkable things to me that comes through in your book is how little we actually know about those final moments for this massive freighter on a well-traveled route.
And that's why I don't try to quite solve the mystery that happened. I certainly promote some theories versus others based on new evidence that I've dug up and others have as well. But the best quote on that comes from Ruth Hudson. She's the mother of Bruce Hudson, her only child, who's on the ship as a deckhand, 22 years old. She said, "Only 30 know. 29 men and God, and no one's talking." So without witnesses, we're left to guess.
And there are heartbreaking stories of crew members who were planning to retire after the run. And I want to note here that you do a wonderful job of sharing some details about them and their time on the Fitz. There was a man who never got to meet his unborn child, and a child, of course, that never knew his father. And during this interview, we don't have enough time to do justice to all those moments, but I would like you to share the story of Eddie Bindon and what he did during his last couple of days on shore before his final voyage.
Eddie Bindon was a veteran of 25 years. He was the first assistant engineer on the ship. He bought his wife a 25th anniversary ring in Duluth, Minnesota, right across from Superior, Wisconsin, where the ship was docked, and gave it to a friend to give to her. And why he did this, only Eddie Bindon could know, because he's going to be home in Toledo, near his home in Ohio, 3 days later. Of course, the ship goes down. And then about a week later, Ms. Bindon received a 25th anniversary diamond ring in the mail from her husband.
Now, 50 years later, if you talk with people about the Edmunds Fitzgerald, especially with people who aren't old enough to remember the incident itself, people often mention the song The Wreck of the Edmund Fitzgerald by Gordon Lightfoot as the way they got to know a little bit about the story. And you write that Lightfoot was really torn about releasing what he'd written, and then the families had very mixed reactions when it came out. How did all of that play out?
Sure. Well, he's a sailor. He knows the Great Lakes. Cares about them. He had a melody in his head, an old Irish sea dirge, basically, but no words. And then the articles came in, and he realized, okay, this is what I need to write about. So he writes the song, but he does not want to record it. He's very sensitive about this and very self-conscious. And finally, they're recording in Toronto, but they're not going to record this song. And finally, they finished the album with a day and a half left. And the studio producer says, "Look, dude, I'm charging you whether you play the song or not." The guys in the band had never heard the song before. And when they finished the song, they said that wasn't half bad. And then they said, "Let's try it again." Not as good. They come back the next day, try it 4 or 5 more times. Not as good. The song you hear on the radio is the first time the band ever played it. And that never, ever happens.
Right.
It's what they were feeling. And it should be noted, even the families who were not sure about that song at first became huge believers in Gordon Lightfoot himself and the song.
Well, John, as you note, the Edmund Fitzgerald's one of the many ships to go down on the Great Lakes. And there had been some other significant and deadly wrecks in the late 50s and the 60s, and some of them also on the final run of the season in November in a major storm. Lots of similarities. Did the wreck of the Edmund Fitzgerald lead to any safety changes?
The Edmund Fitzgerald changed the entire industry. Like I said before, there are 6,000 shipwrecks between 1875 and 1975. There has not been one since. So 6,000, one per week for a century, right? And none for half a century. Why? Like one of my experts told me, when do you fix anything? When it's broken. So this got so much attention, Titanic going down, basically, that they finally fixed forecasting for good. They fixed communications with the captains. And also, third, common sense. All right? They simply do not go out in that kind of weather anymore. They used to all the time.
Author John U. Bacon. His new book, The Gales of November, The Untold Story of the Edmund Fitzgerald, is out now. The wreck of the freighter on the Great Lakes happened 50 years ago this past fall. You're listening to Statewide. There's more to come. We'll be talking about nursing. That's ahead.
The legend lives on from the Chippewa on down. the big lake they call Gitche-Gumee. The lake, it is said, never gives up her dead when the skies of November turn gloomy. With a load of iron ore, 26,000 tons more than the Edmund Fitzgerald weighed empty. That good ship and true was a bone to be chewed when the gales of November came early.
Welcome back to Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. In her short life so far, 10-year-old Milan Ellis has already moved 6 times. She wrote about her experiences in her debut children's book, The Adventures of a Military Kid. Jonathan Turner has more.
The daughter of the commander of Rock Island Arsenal's Joint Munitions Command, Milan has penned an uplifting story about courage, friendship, and finding home in every new place, a reality lived by thousands of military children across the world. She and her family have been in the Quad Cities since August, and she was inspired by the moves, transitions, and new beginnings that come with being part of a military household.
I wanted to write the message that, like, in, like, a kind of funny, like, kid kind of way, that sometimes military kids struggle making friends, but also that, like, it's good to be a military kid. And it's exciting with all the ups and downs. In boxes.
Milan's dad, a native of Jamaica, is Paul P.J. Ellis, Command Sergeant Major of the Joint Munitions Command, and they live with her mom and younger brother on the Arsenal. For WVIK News, this is Jonathan Turner.
The percentage of people killed in motor vehicle crashes involving alcohol has increased statewide since 2019. That's according to a new report on alcohol use in adults and teens by the Illinois Department of Public Health. The report shows that in 2022, 37% of fatal crashes involved alcohol. That's a jump from 2019. Leslie Wise helped write the report for the IDPH.
Anytime that we see an increase in preventable deaths, that is something for us to take into account and be aware of and see if we can help spread the message of these preventable fatalities.
The report also shows that from 2020 to 2023, the state reported more than 2,300 deaths related to issues like liver disease and alcohol dependency syndrome. Nursing has been added to a list of professions that the Department of Education is no longer considering a professional degree. This change is related to efforts to cap the number of students eligible for federal student loans and the amount of money they can borrow. Nursing advocates and program administrators are voicing concern about the repercussions of that change. Dan Tucker spoke with Eileen Collins, the dean of the University of Illinois Chicago's College of Nursing.
What was your first reaction when you heard this news about nursing maybe not being considered a professional degree?
Well, actually, I was kind of outraged because it really affects our students, our future students. When you go for advanced education in nursing, the cost is high, and many of our students apply for federal loans to help pay for those costs. And by capping those loans, students won't be able to go for advanced degrees like nurse practitioner degrees, nurse midwifery degrees, or nurse anesthesia degrees. Those are primarily the degrees that would be affected by this.
Yeah. How much can some of those degrees cost at UIC or other places? I mean, what is the range that we're talking about here?
So to become a nurse practitioner, it's generally about 4 years after you get your baccalaureate degree. So you're talking about $100,000 to $110,000 all in. CRNA tuition is higher. It's a much more intensive program.
Is that nurse anesthetist?
Nurse anesthetist program.
If I can say that properly.
Sorry. That's why I say CRNA.
Right.
And so to become a CRNA, the average cost is about $150,000. And it's 36 months all in. You're a full-time student for those 36 months.
Yeah, so not only is there a lot of schooling, but, I mean, we should just acknowledge the really important role that nurses play. I mean, I was just thinking back to some conversations we did with nurses here on our talk shows during the pandemic, during COVID-19, and just hearing about different things that they had to deal with on the ground, but also the effect on their mental health. So talk to us just a little bit about the role that nurses play and what they do on a day-to-day basis.
Well, nurses, particularly those nurses that would be affected by these federal loan limitations, many of them are in primary care.
Mm-hmm.
So if you go take your child to a pediatrician, sometimes you will be seen by a nurse practitioner. Nurse practitioners work in the emergency departments. Nurse practitioners deliver babies, particularly in the rural communities. And probably most often, if you're getting a procedure done, you will probably, your anesthesia will be administered by a nurse anesthetist. So in the rural areas, about 80% of anesthesia is provided by nurse anesthetists. And actually, about 50% of anesthesia providers are nurse anesthetists. There's a real shortage of anesthesia providers. So if you go for your colonoscopy or you're getting a procedure done, in all likelihood, it will be a nurse anesthetist that will be administering your anesthesia.
Okay. And you mentioned that, you know, this could have a big effect on how much federal loan money folks could get for some of those graduate programs. I do want to hear a couple of clips that we've got here from a nursing student and also a current nurse. We heard from In the Loop producer Micah Yason's sister, who's studying nursing at Purdue University. She also has hopes to become a nurse practitioner in the future, and she worries the change will make it harder for her and her peers to reach their goals in an already difficult program.
In terms of my position on the change as a nursing student, is just wondering, you know, where do the changes being put on these degrees and education in general, where does it end? And will I still be able to do what I want to do, study what I want to study, and along with all these other students that are currently going through school, will we be able to do what we want to do?
We also heard from Lupe. She's an ICU nurse in the city who's also currently applying for a Doctor of Nursing Practice or DNP program. She says the Department of Ed's change is both disappointing and discouraging, but that what worries her the most is the financial impact on people who want to further their education.
I know a lot of my coworkers and myself want to pursue advanced degrees in the future because bedside burnout is real and furthering education opens doors to roles that are more sustainable. But the reality is that graduate nursing programs are expensive. And when nursing is no longer recognized as a professional degree, it only limits financial aid and increases the debt burden on people who are already stretched thin. So this isn't just a classification issue. It creates yet another barrier for nurses trying to grow and advance in the field. And at a time when we need more highly educated nurses, that's pretty much the last thing we should be doing or worrying about.
So, Eileen, you're the dean at the University of Illinois Chicago College of Nursing. You're hearing there from a nursing student, from a current nurse. What goes through your mind? What was your reaction to what they had to say?
Well, I think your second guest talked about this is just really bad timing. When you think about healthcare, it's growing more and more complex. Any healthcare provider, whether it be a nurse, a physical therapist, a physician, a dentist, the training that it takes to work in those fields just continues to grow, the knowledge that you have. So to think that we can cut back on that or that we can somehow make that cheaper is just very unrealistic. Most nursing schools now have simulation labs where we practice on mannequins instead of practicing on human beings. So there's less, you can make mistakes in a very safe space. But all of that costs money. And to think that you're going to be able to lower tuition costs by limiting the amount of money that students can have to go to school is just very unrealistic.
Yeah, the Department of Education did come out and say in response to some of the criticism that, well, you know, some of these programs just cost too much to begin with. But you're saying technology changes, there are more demands on the students so that you really do need to pay that amount.
Right. And for faculty, for example, in nursing schools, you need a doctorate. Most schools, 80% of schools use doctorally prepared nurses to prepare their students. And that requires education on their part. They will also be limited. And right now, the American Association of Colleges of Nursing has done research, and they say that there are 68,000 nursing students who are turned away from nursing schools because we don't have enough faculty to teach them.
Oh, wow.
So that's another problem. So you're not only contributing to the loss of advanced practice nurses, but if you don't have the faculty to teach your entry-level nurses, it's going to cause a huge problem in an already bad nursing shortage.
Talking with Eileen Collins, Dean of the University of Illinois Chicago College of Nursing. Eileen, just before that, you mentioned the nursing shortage. I was hoping you could expand on that a bit. How bad is it, and how did we get there?
Well, the nursing shortage is quite bad, and it's worse in the rural communities. If you just look at the job ads, every hospital is looking for nurses. And nurses not only work in hospitals, they work out in the community, they work out in public health. So this is something that hospitals are paying sign-on bonuses to get nurses to come work for them. But it's particularly problematic in the rural areas. And we've been trying to fill that. And then the pandemic didn't do us any favors. The year after the pandemic, we saw nursing enrollment in nursing schools drop. Now it's back up. It's picking back up. But at a time when we need nurses most, this is just very bad timing.
Yeah, I think I read some statistics that there was around a little bit more than 50,000 nurses needed. There's a shortage of 50,000 nurses now, but that, you know, we could be looking by 2030 at well over 60,000 nurses needed. That just sounds like an astounding number.
It is an astounding number. And when you think about the baby boomers are aging,
that's
when you need the most medical care. You look at many hospitals are closing their OBGYN departments.
Yeah, many in Chicago.
Many in Chicago. So that not only creates a shortage of physicians, but that's where nurse midwives come in as well. They can fill some of those gaps.
Yeah. Now, I have to assume that despite all of this news, you still think that nursing is a profession that folks should go into. You're nodding your head. Tell me, you know, what would your pitch be to someone about why this is a really important something to consider for a career or just an important part of our society?
Oh, I think it's one of the most fulfilling jobs that I could have ever gone into. And I have never once been sorry that I went into nursing. The other thing about nursing is that there's so many different things. If you start off and you're in a position that perhaps you don't like, or as one of your guests said, you're getting burnt out.
Yeah.
Don't leave the profession. Look for something else. You can go into go from a hospital to a clinic, or you could go to public health, or you could go into administration. You can go into education. There's so many things that you can do with a nursing degree. And it's,
you can become the dean of the nursing school.
You can become the dean of the nursing school.
How did you get your start?
I started at a community hospital, and I actually worked as a nursing assistant through college and then worked at the community hospital, then went on to a university hospital. And you just kind of different things interested me. I got interested in research, so I had a research lab for a long time, and then education. So you just kind of go from one thing to another. It's never boring.
That sounds good. What are you and your colleagues, maybe other folks in your position, doing to try to either get the attention of the Department of Education or turn this around?
Well, certainly there are efforts out there to contact congressional members, but it's not, they did not make the decision. So it's to contact them to put pressure on the Department of Education who did make this decision. The other thing that we're doing is leaning on our philanthropic partners to try and get more scholarships for our students to fill this gap that that's being created by the federal government.
How many students are there at UIC at the School of Nursing?
We have 2,500 students right now.
Yeah, so that's fairly big.
We have it's a large program. It's the largest program in the state.
Yeah. And, you know, given what you had said about this could affect how much federal loan money folks get, what would your advice be to someone who is maybe thinking about going into the profession but now worried that, well, I can't afford $100,000. Do you have any – are there any avenues that they can take to maybe pay for school that they might not be aware of?
I would say to them, look for scholarships. You know, the hours that you spend looking for a scholarship can really pay off. The other thing is there are some employers that will provide tuition reimbursement, so that is another option. It makes it harder because nursing school is hard to get through, even harder if you're working while you're doing it. But those are other options that students have. Talk to people. Sometimes you can find funding that way.
Yeah, and you mentioned that you're trying to get the attention of Congress folks. What is your next step here?
I mean, our next step is to continue to lean heavily on our congressional members. That's what the profession is doing right now. There's also letters being signed by not only nursing, but medicine, dentistry, physical therapy, occupational therapy, social work, everybody getting together to let people know, let the public know what the outcomes of this and what the ramifications of this are. I mean, people hear, well, you know, why are you getting all this money to go to school? First of all, with a loan, you have to pay it back. So it's not like it's free money. You have to pay it back. And nurses, they have good jobs when they come out. They pay their loans back. So it's putting pressure on things like that so that we can reverse this decision. It's not too late.
That's Eileen Collins, Dean of the University of Illinois Chicago College of Nursing. She talked with Dan Tucker about the Department of Education no longer considering nursing a professional degree and the possible repercussions of that change. We're out of time for Statewide. Thanks for being along with us. Join us next week. We'll be back with more reports and conversations from in and around Illinois and the Midwest. Find us where you get your podcasts through the NPR app and at nprillinois.org. I'm Sean Crawford. Statewide is a production of NPR Illinois with help from other Illinois Public Radio stations.